Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control, and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor, and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Out.
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And he messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, I hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Don't.
Did you prime it? That little rubber ball right there next to the spark plug. Got to push it in 3 times before you try to start it. Gets the gas going to the car.
You want the truth? I ain't never used one of these. Never had no call to.
Yeah, well, I didn't pick you up for your landscaping skills. All these Spanish, they on paper too. Only use people like y'all. Sometimes it comes back on and sometimes it works out fine.
Well, how long you been uptown?
10 years.
Hotter than a motherfucker out here.
Yeah, it's hot. Every day. You're gonna be riding in the back of that hard truck, bouncing around. Every day. And your back's gonna be yelling at you. Every day. I used to drive an SL. Pretty gold convertible. Nice rims. I don't even think on that car no more.
You put it behind you, huh?
Some can't. I'm just saying, you want to stay on the straight. Ain't going to be no big reward to it. This is it, right here. Prime that bitch 3 times. She'll start right up.
How'd it go?
We got one out of 2 of them motherfuckers, you know.
You mean you motherfuckers come strolling in here all walking tall and shit?
Yo, B.I., man, I'm saying, man, we was blazing on them dudes, man, you know what I'm saying? Just got in the heat, man. We was blazing, though. It was late.
All right, relax, man. I already heard. Go sit down. I'm not tweaking behind none of this. That's one less motherfucker that's breathing than was yesterday, you know what I'm saying? So we all good. But I'm surprised with you, though, man. Shit didn't get by you back when.
Well, my man's fault, man. I unloaded on the younger too soon, man. Gave him enough room to buck and run, man. I fucked that shit up myself, you know.
Hold on. So on me. I had that kid in my sights. Close enough to take off his Kango and half his dome with it. Couldn't squeeze the trigger. Couldn't do it, man.
Why not?
Wasn't in me, I guess. You know, whatever it is in you that lets you flow like you flow and do that thing, it ain't in me no more.
All right. So you done soldiering, but you ain't done. Could use you for what you got in your head. We're gonna put you on a corner. You could be inside.
Oh, man. I ain't making myself clear. The game ain't in me no more. None of it.
But you ain't done shit else. You know what I'm saying? So what you gonna do?
But it can't be this.
All right, then. We straight.
B, he was a man in his time, you know?
A man today.
Spirit could kill. You know I've seen a lot of people walking around with tombstones in their eyes. But the butcher don't care. Oh, if you live or if you die.
In July, we brought you a story about poverty in Alabama, which was spurred by a report from the United Nations Special Rapporteur.
You see that? I want you to remember that no bastard ever won war by dying for his country. He won it by making the other poor dumb bastard die for his country. And then, all this stuff you heard about America not wanting to fight, wanting to stay out of the war, is a lot of horse dung. Americans traditionally love to fight. All real Americans love the sting of battle. When you were kids, you all admired the champion marble shooter, the fastest runner, big league ball players, the toughest boxers. Americans love a winner and will not tolerate a loser. Americans play to win all the time. I wouldn't give a hoot in hell for a man who lost and laughed. That's why Americans have never lost and will never lose a war. Because the very thought of losing is hateful to Americans. Now, an army is a team. It lives, eats, sleeps, fights as a team. This individuality stuff is a bunch of crap. The bilious bastards who wrote that stuff about individuality for the Saturday Evening Post don't know anything more about real battle than they do about fornicating. Now, we have the finest food and equipment, the best spirit, and the best men in the world. You know, my God, I actually pity those poor bastards we're going up against. By God, I do. We're not just going to shoot the bastards. We're going to cut out their living guts and use them to grease the treads of our tanks. We're going to murder those lousy Hun bastards by the bushel. Now, some of you boys, I know, are wondering whether or not you'll chicken out under fire. Don't worry about it. I can assure you that you will all do your duty. The Nazis are the enemy. Wade into them. Spill their blood. Shoot them in the belly. When you put your hand into a bunch of goo that a moment before was your best friend's face, you know what to do. Now, there's another thing I want you to remember. I don't want to get any messages saying that we are holding our position. We're not holding anything. Let the Hun do that. We are advancing constantly, and we're not interested in holding on to anything except the enemy. We're going to hold on to him by the nose, and we're going to kick him in the ass. We're going to kick the hell out of him all the time, and we're going to go through him like crap through a goose. There's one thing that you men will be able to say when you get back home. And you may thank God for it. 30 years from now, when you're sitting around your fireside with your grandson on your knee, and he asks you, what did you do in the great World War II? You won't have to say, well, I shoveled shit in Louisiana. All right, now you sons of bitches, you know how I feel. I will be proud to lead you wonderful guys into battle anytime, anywhere. That's all.
Good morning.
Valerie, how did you learn that your boy had died?
Well, my daughter, first of all, she's on Facebook or whatever, and she saw the live streaming of the actual event. I, on the other hand, I didn't know what was going on. I just heard her screaming and hollering through the house, and I was like, what's going on? And she's like, my brother's dying. My brother's been shot. Oh, my God. He's on Facebook. He's dying. And I'm like, what are you talking about? So I immediately jumped up, and we just headed out the door. And I'm like, where are they? Where are they? And we really couldn't get a fix on it until she said that it was a sign that stated Falcon Heights, you know, like entry into that little area. And I said, no, I know exactly where I'm going. And we arrived on a scene, and it was cordoned off, and the police, you know, they were of really no assistance to me because, first of all, they didn't know where he was, what hospital, because I was adamant about being with my son because I did not want my son to die by himself.
Forgive me interrupting, but did you ever talk to your son about how to behave, if ever in contact with the police?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's really a shame that we as African-American people, we have to have that talk with our sons and our daughters as to if you're approached by the police, don't say anything. Do exactly what they ask you to do. Just comply. Comply, comply, comply. Because it has gotten to the point where this is a routine thing. Black people getting killed by a police officer and there's no consequences. No one is held accountable. But I had that talk with my son. Yes, I did.
Right. Now,
often.
Let me
often.
Just talk now to your lawyer for a moment. Judge Glenda Hatchett, you're going to fight this case. What real chance?
Absolutely.
What real chance is that there will be justice? And what chance is there even that there will even be a trial?
Well, let me first of all explain that I will not have the responsibility for prosecuting the police officers. I am representing the family on the civil side, but I am doing everything I can to urge that there be a special prosecutor on behalf of the family. I've already made those formal requests. We will be making a formal request to the Department of Justice with the U.S. Attorney General because we want all eyes on this case. I have to explain that this is a man who was employed, who was loved by his family, adored by the community, who all of his coworkers, all of the children loved him. He had no felony record. He was not combative. He was not fleeing from the police. He was still in his seatbelt when he was shot. He was permitted to have, he had a legal permit to have a gun. And so if this happens to someone who is in full compliance, how can it possibly be justified? And I am going to do everything in my power to raise the level of consciousness and visibility on this case, and we are going to be insisting that the prosecutor proceed vigorously on this case.
Right.
There is no other alternative.
Let me just come back to you in a moment, go back to Valerie. Valerie, you must have been buoyed by what you saw on the platform of the Democrat convention, because it seems that the Democratic Party and its candidate are determined somehow to rectify this desperate imbalance.
Yes, it needs to stop because we cannot coexist with this type of behavior. There needs to be accountability. It just can't continue to go on like this because you don't know how it's going to end. It may not end well because you have, on the other hand, people who are supposed to protect and serve you, and they're the ones that's actually committing crimes legally, and it has to stop. There has to be accountability.
Right.
This type of behavior shouldn't be going on with our police officers.
Valerie, let me ask your judge friend, Glenda. Judge, what chance do you really think that the establishment, and you're talking to the establishment, you're talking to the Justice Department, what chance they will comply and provide a special prosecutor and answer the requests you're making?
Well, I am very hopeful. And the reason that I am representing the Castile family is because I hope to use the credibility that I have nationally, and I am going to vigorously pursue this. We have asked not only the local district attorney, we've asked the state attorney general and the governor, all in a very formalized request for a special prosecutor.
Right.
There is enough for the Justice Department to come in and do a separate investigation of practices.
Right.
And what we believe has been a history of profiling African-American citizens in
Judge,
this community.
Judge
so
Kendra has hit.
I operate from the side of hope, and we are going to work vigorously to make sure that this time
right.
is different.
Judge, thank you very, very much indeed for joining us. And Valerie Castile, thank you very much. And commiserations, and may you reach peace. Thank you very much.
Garner. First of all, my condolences.
Thank you.
Your husband is now the face of bias in our law enforcement. How do you feel about that?
I feel that he was murdered unjustly. I feel like, I don't even feel like it's a black and white thing, honestly. You know, in my opinion, I really don't feel like it's a black and white thing. I feel like it's just something that he continued to do, and the police knew, you know, they knew. It wasn't like it was a shock. They knew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they knew him by name. They harassed us. They said things to us. We would go shopping. You know, they hi, cigarette man. Hey, cigarette man, wife, you know, and stuff like that. And I would just say, Eric, just keep walking. Don't say anything. Don't respond. You know, don't give them a reason to do anything to you. And, you know, and he just felt like, said, babe, they keep harassing me. And I say, just ignore them, Eric. And he said, but how much can I ignore them? And I would say, just stay away from the block, you know? Just find something else to do. And he's like, what else can I do? I keep getting sick. He tried working with the Parks Department, but he had asthma, you know? He had issues, you know? Heavy guy. And he was very lazy. You know, he didn't like to do anything. He wasn't used to it. So.
But you bring up race, and she has tried to say, I don't want to deal with race as mm-hmm. the issue, but clearly they treat differently. If he was of a different right. race with the same background, no one has tried to sugarcoat anyone's background here,
right.
would he have been treated the same way? And that's what we're talking about. You cannot have a broken windows policing
right.
if you have broken training, broken accountability, and police that claim that I have the right to bring you down and then later say it's resisting even when a videotape says it's not. So we're not talking about making victims saints,
right.
but we're talking about not giving a pass to police who do what's wrong. You can't have two wrongs and make one civil right.
Right, and I want to
In July, we brought you a story about poverty in Alabama, which was spurred by a report from the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, Philip Alston. Alston toured America, spotlighting third world-style poverty in our first world country. NewsHour Weekend Special Correspondent Simon Ostrowski continues following in Alston's footsteps with a report on poverty in Los Angeles. Supported in part by a grant from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, this report is part of our ongoing series about poverty and opportunity in America, Chasing the Dream.
Los Angeles, the home of some of the most desirable zip codes in the country. But right at the heart of this wealthy metropolis exist conditions that have been described by the city's own newspaper, the Los Angeles Times, as a national disgrace. One expanse of 50 city blocks is an area that's become synonymous with poverty, crime, and homelessness. It's existed for decades and has dogged successive mayoral administrations that have tried to eradicate it. It's called Skid Row, and is home to an estimated 2,000 members of Los Angeles County's homeless community.
LA has one of the highest rents in the nation. And the reason why come there's so many tents out here is because people can't afford to live in a house.
Steve Richardson, who goes by the name General Dogon, is an activist at the LA Community Action Network, which advocates for the city's homeless community.
The majority of the people that you see sleeping on the streets are black, and these are folks that have fell through the poverty level. It makes me really mad.
Long the subject of local and national concern, Skid Row recently garnered international attention when it became the focus of a report written by the United Nations Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty, Philip Alston, whose job more often involves assessing conditions in the developing world.
The homelessness on the streets in LA is pretty staggering in terms of magnitude, in terms of how long running it is. There is a chronic shortage of affordable housing.
Nationally, homelessness has been mostly on the decline since 2010, though it ticked upward slightly in 2017 to nearly 554,000 people without their own roof over their heads in a so-called point-in-time count. The Los Angeles area, meanwhile, has trended in the opposite direction, as the cost of living here soared over the last decade, forcing thousands onto the street in what has amounted to a nearly 50% increase in homelessness since 2012 to almost 53,000 people. The sheer size of Skid Row makes it look like a refugee camp. But according to a 2017 report by several homelessness advocacy groups, the availability of toilets here is worse than in a UN-run Syrian refugee camp.
It smells of urine everywhere. Skid Row had about 10 toilets, I think, for thousands of people. So it's a pretty bad setup.
So this is, call it the big green machine, and it's a bathroom.
According to the LA Community Action Network, nearly 1,800 unsheltered people in Skid Row share access to just 9 toilets like this one, which means many avoid them altogether and use buckets, which are then emptied into the streets and trash cans.
And that was PTSD, but I didn't know nothing about that.
Willie Van Seals is a Vietnam vet suffering from heroin addiction, one of almost 3,900 homeless veterans in L.A. County.
I'll show you. The buckets that we use are urinate, bowel movement. There's nowhere around here to use the bathroom. And that's hard on a person. You know what I mean? Especially you got to walk around and find somewhere to take a crap. Yeah. Come on now.
The authorities know hygiene is an issue here. The county health department reported that its teams observed feces and urine on 8 of 10 sidewalks during a survey back in 2012. Street washes like this one have been instituted to help stop the spread of disease.
If we don't power wash the streets, we end up with what we had years ago when we had a tuberculosis outbreak or hepatitis outbreak or some kind of disease. It has to be done. It has to be done.
Officer Dion Joseph has been patrolling the streets of Skid Row for close to 2 decades. He says he's seen well-meaning policies to improve health conditions backfire.
Years ago, we had 27 porta potties in Skid Row. My concern was that they would be taken over by the criminal element. And day one, that's exactly what happened. When those bathrooms were here, gangsters were charging the homeless $1 to $5 to use the porta potties for what they were designed for.
While we're with him, Officer Joseph receives a complaint.
I've got these people who pulled up in front of the doorway. I've asked them repeatedly to move. And trying to have a rational conversation with the irrational people, I just don't want to do it.
How are you? I'm sorry to bother you. There's a gentleman here who has a business, and the law says you can't be within 10 feet of his doorway. Can you guys move about 10 feet this way so we can have his space?
He resolves the situation without incident. But the UN report points to data from the LA Times showing that 14,000 homeless people were arrested in LA in 2016, a 31% increase since 2011. The report encouraged authorities to shift from a criminal justice response to a human rights-centered response to homelessness.
Homelessness is being criminalized in many ways. And it's as though you sort of keep moving the pieces around the chessboard and suddenly it's going to improve. Instead of saying, okay, we actually need to work out how to create places where these people can go.
I agree with the UN. We shouldn't be the tip of the spear. Fix the system, especially in places like Skid Row, where many individuals struggle with dual diagnosis, where they're addicts and mentally ill. We don't want to be the tip of the spear, but we have to be until a solution's arrived.
According to Victor Hinderleiter of the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, mental health and addiction are a huge factor contributing to homelessness.
Approximately 30% of people experiencing homelessness self-report that they have a severe mental health disorder. About 30% of people experiencing homelessness self-report that they have a substance use disorder. Homelessness, in and of itself, is a traumatic experience.
Christina Miller, the LA Mayor's Senior Project Manager of Homeless Strategies, agrees that addressing homelessness is a multi-tiered process, but disagrees that the homeless are being criminalized.
And instead of leading with police, leading with enforcement, we are doing everything we can to lead with services, because we know that police officers are not social workers, that it's not necessarily in their purview, and having an enforcement-heavy response is not ultimately going to get people off the streets.
Activists say they know what will get people off the streets.
The solution is simple. This is what the solution is. This is the only thing that ends homelessness, is this right here, house keys. And until everybody got them, hey, you got to be good neighbors, because there's going to be people sleeping on the streets.
There are a lot of solutions that we are focusing on currently in terms of trying to expand our interim shelter bed capacity. But we also know what the only solution is to homelessness, which is permanent housing.
Miller told NewsHour Weekend the city of L.A. had embarked on an unprecedented drive to build 10,000 units of housing for the chronically homeless, those who've repeatedly ended up on the streets or been there for at least a year. It's funded through a $1.2 billion city bond over the next 10 years. That's in addition to a $30 million bridge home program directed at providing interim housing in the meantime. And the efforts may have started to pay off. This year, the homeless count in L.A. County went down for the first time since 2014, only modestly, from 55,000 people to just under 53,000, but it bucks a six-year-long trend in the opposite direction.
We are cautiously optimistic. We are celebrating the fact that there seems to be a change in the direction of the trajectory, and it does tell us that we're doing something right.
Well, they were considerate enough to give us a pantry?
Jose Soto, another veteran, is one of the lucky ones who's recently been housed after years in and out of prison in Skid Row.
I'm really happy with the closet space, but what do you fill it with?
Soto, who's in recovery from drug and alcohol addiction, gave us a tour of the residence the city's provided to him free of charge.
I've been on and off the street for, 14 years. And in my situation, it was all due to substance abuse. I just like to get drunk a lot every day. And then before you know it, the lifestyle catches up and I'm one of the people on Skid Row or under a bridge.
Until newer housing comes online, homes like this are in very limited supply. Only veterans who've gone through a lengthy recovery process from substance abuse qualify for this building.
They treat us like trash.
For vet Willie Van Seals, who's still struggling with addiction, that seems like a distant prospect.
I went through rehab.
Okay.
And when I went through, they promised me when I got through that they would actually give me my voucher and I could go and find me a place to stay.
Okay.
And none of that happened. Okay. This is where I ended up at.
So did you manage to kick the habit in rehab?
Nah.
America paints herself as a good Samaritan country. I'm glad the UN came here, because you see third world conditions right here, you know, in the richest country in the world, that's worse than other countries.
The United Nations report notwithstanding, there are other indications things may be improving for the homeless in L.A. In 2016, Angelenos voted overwhelmingly for a tax increase directed at funding the creation of homes for the chronically homeless. And while tents still line the streets of Skid Row, this year, chronic homelessness has dropped 18% in L.A. County.
When it rains, you must have something on this floor.
But for Willie Van Seals and others like him, Los Angeles still has a long way to go.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here, but the work never stops. Yuba's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yuba's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yuba makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe. But they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yuba runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yuba in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not Yuba. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yuba builds its own parts on site. So Mr. He's supplier is only a bike ride away.
有多少数量？三千个是吧？三千个，赶快送过来。好，这边没有了，已经没有了。是是。But
even the supplier is dangerously low on stock.
大概因为现在生产线已经停掉了，然后我大概要赶快把它送过去哈。好的。七点钟准时，安排送量。对对对。Mr.
He has found barely enough parts to last the day.
好，谢谢谢谢。好。
When he gets another urgent call. Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yuba started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year. But Yuba wants more.
好，前几座，前几座，加油，看齐，向前看。
Little wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. Yupa's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Kelly, you muted?
Up, everybody. This is Jay, and this video is about, is Tariq worth $2 million? Now, we all know that he's a damn fool, and he deserves what he's getting, but is he worth $2 million? Before we do, let's hit that like button. I need to get 200 likes for this video, and if you haven't already, please subscribe and bang that bell. I'm trying to reach 20,000 subs by the end of the month. Let's get into it. Now, Tariq, we all know, is a damn fool. He doesn't listen to Ghost or Tasha. And he's been corrupted by Kanan and turned against his father by Kanan and Tasha. And now he thinks that he's a dope boy when all he is a dorm room dope boy. He doesn't know anything about real life situations. And so he tried to get over on Vincent and the Olive Garden dope boy crew. And he bought some baby aspirin and tried to pass it off as being some pills, ecstasy, or whatever the case. And no, that would not work. If anything, he would have been better off trying to cut it. But he's an idiot. He knows nothing about this. He thought because they look similar that Vincent wouldn't know anything. And yeah, maybe with the eye test he wouldn't know. But once they began to sell the merch, then people would complain saying that these were duds, that the strength was weak, it was nothing, and that ruined his business.
Okay, now let's see if you can. All right, 314, can you hear me now?
Yeah, hello? LA, what's going on with your technology, man? You used to be the best.
I don't know what's going on. I don't know if it's Blog Talk or my modem. I do not know, but it happened yesterday. And then today, because we had somebody on from Chicago, but she said the same thing you said. So I had to hang up the phone on this end and then call back in, and now you can hear me. I had to do the same thing yesterday twice.
So well, how you doing?
I don't know. No complaints. You know, I wanted to get feedback from anybody who's interested in what happened in Highland Park, Illinois.
Well,
with that mass shooting yesterday.
That.
Huh?
Well,
yeah, six people that got shot and killed.
Highland Park is outside Chicago. What should be looked at is what was going on there. Since Friday through Sunday, you had over 56 people shot.
Now, all right. How are we looking at this? Highland Park, Illinois, is a suburb of Chicago. So
right.
the Chicago Police Department would not be investigating. I'm assuming that Highland Park, Illinois.
That's not their jurisdiction, no.
Exactly, yeah. So now.
So that's there in that community. Whatever the heck happened, I don't know. Nobody else.
Right.
Knows.
Now, hold on. Now, you mentioned something about Friday. What started on Friday?
I say from Friday, that's the weekend starts. through Sunday.
Right.
And the papers reported the shootings over the weekend. That's their weekend coverage, and that starts Friday. Actually, right, yeah, to tell you the truth, well, yeah, it starts Friday and runs through Sunday. And you had over 56 shot, I believe it is. So you got people that's just doing some terrible things. No matter who they are, what shape they are, they do terrible things. But in Chicago, this has been going on I've been keeping track of it for at least 3 years. So far this year, in 21 days, you don't had close to, if not 300 people shot since Memorial Day. And about 56 murders.
I wonder if any of this has affected tourism in Chicago.
I don't know. I ain't going there.
Chicago's had a pretty healthy tourist economy.
Yeah,
vacations.
You got people vacating the city, leaving.
Well, that's a part of that's due to the high cost of living. And I guess you got to attribute crime to that too.
You probably right about it. I don't know about the cost of living in that city, but I know from newspaper articles that it's been over 3,000 along Lake Shore Drive.
That's all prime real estate.
Millionaires. Yeah, millionaires. They move further on the north.
Can you imagine what the property taxes are? Or the condo? Can you imagine what the condo fees are on something on Lakeshore Drive? I wouldn't even want to think about it.
Where her administration did raise taxes. That's what the Democrats do. And some ratchet Republicans, they like to raise taxes.
Those social programs they got to pay for.
Yeah, social programs.
A lot of social programs.
Public safety.
Yeah, public safety, that's expensive. You know, then I'm sure they had to, their infrastructure, which that's an ongoing cost to upgrade that.
The schools are terrible.
Oh, God. And it's a unionized school system, too, so that's expensive.
Yeah, if you think about it, all the things you can lay out there, bad schools, safety, when the safety becomes a factor, people move. When people move, your tax base drops. Crime picks up. Crime requires more public safety. You can't get police officers. They quit because of the George Floyd effect.
They convicted the police officer in Chicago. I forgot the case, though. There's so many of these cases.
That was Mark Laquan, somebody. And the police officer was Van Dyke. Van Dyke should have been put in prison. Because he killed that kid.
Well, Chicago.
Van Dyke, white police officer, drives up on the scene. Last one, police had already been there standing around. He drives up, pulls out his gun, and shoots this kid just walking by. I don't know why the police around and didn't shoot him.
Well,
something wrong with these people's minds. And I told you before, I think that sickness of the black population is cursed.
There are others that think the same way.
But what else is going on? How's tiny homes coming along?
We had a talk about that this morning, but I don't want to say anything until we show the video. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, tiny homes, of course, it's either raising kids is another thing. It could be a
good project for retirees that don't want to have to be involved in maintaining a property in the form of landscaping and grass and stuff like that. But for a
growing family,
for a retired couple, that there would be a good deal.
Yeah, that or I've seen some couples that have young children that that's worked, but, you know, they've had a couple of acres along with that, and they also planned on, you know, building something larger for the family. One family of four, what they did was they got a compound. They got about 2 acres of land. And they got a they built the compound on there. So they built one house. I wouldn't call it. It was a small house, not quite tiny, but small. So mom and dad, that was mom and dad's place. And then in the compound, walking distance and visible of everybody, you know, the daughter had her own tiny house. And then the son had his own tiny house. And then they had another building, which was like the family family house. Well, entertainment house, where they can watch movies together, talk, that type thing. And then when they get tired of each other, they
can
go. Well,
if you got a big family, stuff like that will work. But most people not marry like they used to. They're not having large families, of course. So something like that in your later years is just not feasible. My daughter's house there in St. Louis County, she's got 3 full-size fireplaces in that house, 3 levels.
How many fireplaces? 3.
3. 3 full-size
fireplaces.
Sounds
like she's living in something like at least 3,000 or 4,000 square feet.
1, 2, 3. Well, she can, her house has 3 levels. One could say it's got 4. And I'm
sounds
trying
like
to
she
get her out of there. Well, it was, but I'm trying to get her out of there because nobody there but her. The son's not going to stay there. He goes back and forth.
The maintenance on that house is
I hate
else.
For him to go to St. Louis because cramps are bad all over the
right.
place. But when you get it, my house, which I is another story, but nobody feel like doing all that crap. Sprinkler system, lawn, landscaping, and trees got to be treated. Colorado spruce.
Yeah, you got to keep it up.
Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to trim them damn things, and you got to do this. No, it's just too much work. I knew this white guy.
Well, eventually she might want to scale back.
Well, yeah, but she can't scale back the house. The house is built.
Right.
She has to. I want to get her to move. She don't. She frowns on that one. I may admit. I say ain't nobody here but you. Look at all this damn grass you have to mow, ride mower, and all that. Nobody have time for that. Any
well,
long.
Her is home, I guess.
Yeah, but
it'd
I know
nice
white
if
person.
Had a nice little compound, and everybody's on the same grounds.
Yeah, then she has one of them damn timeshares in the Ozarks. But I knew a white guy that had a beautiful home off of Clayton Road, and his lawn was beautiful. But I used to drive by there, he'd be on it, laying on his side with scissors, trimming his lawn like it was a Crowvalis haircut. But when he died, then you could see the difference because nobody's taking care of those things. It's kind of like a hobby but, for those that like it, but that's a lot of work.
Quite a bit.
Yeah.
Quite a bit. Then you need the cash flow.
But if you build those if you build those tiny homes, it wouldn't be tiny if you got to make way for young people raising a family. I'd say 3 bedrooms, you know, 2 for the kids and 1 for the husband and wife.
Mm-hmm.
That would be pretty good. You might want to have another one that can turn into for a guest and come on.
Now all that under one roof. Now that wouldn't be a tiny house. That you can get, now with a small house, and with, when I say small, somewhere in the neighborhood of about 800, 900 square feet.
Well, that's when you got a retired couple. Well, if you raise a family, you got to have.
You know what's amazing is when I used to do, just do rooms, and this was in D.C., but I'm sure you got examples of this in St. Louis, too, and other places, where I had some, occasionally I would have like a single parent or mother, and she wants to rent the room with her and two other children. And I'm saying, look, the room's barely enough for like two people, or really one. Of course, I didn't, you know, I said, no, that's, she must have been in some dire straits, but occasionally you do have people like that.
I tell you something, I don't look too good on these gardens people talk about for their house.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody gonna have time for that. My neighbor, he did, of course, then at the time. He had a big garden in his backyard. He had cut trees down, grew everything from cabbage to
if you get into something like that, in my opinion, you need partners. You need partners.
He used to get out there with his tiller and till the hell out of it and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he liked to do. But most people don't like that.
But, like I said, with all that stuff, I think it's best if you have partners. If you're in an urban environment, where they have those community gardens, you know, where you got to
No, he had a garden in the backyard.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. And that takes
him work. And his wife. That was all it was.
Okay.
When him and her died, the daughter came. Matter of fact, he had two daughters and a son. One son.
Yeah, but see, the kids might not want to have nothing to do with it.
Well, then one daughter died, and the other daughter, who was married, she's staying there in the house with her lazy husband. So that's the way those things usually end up.
Yeah. I
tell you what, I think it's better. I think it's, well, you know, sell the big-ass house and go get you a condo. You got to cut grass and stuff.
Yeah, if you don't have no partner or no energy to do it or both.
Right.
Do that. And then if the children, that's the trick. I ran across this right outside of Taft, Oklahoma. This guy, he's gone now, Napoleon Davis. He built, I'm going to do a live stream on him one day. But he built by himself, he built like, I guess you could call it like a little monument to Muscogee Creek Indians. It's, I've visited at least three or four times. Every time I go out there, I visit it. And every time I visit it, and then I'm typically the only one that's out there, except now Mayor Davis, she was the one that took me out there the first couple of times. But, and we're the only two there. Or if I go with somebody else, I'm with the other person driving, we're the only two there. But it's like, I had to post the pictures, because it's really a good work of art, and one man did it. But now he had three children, and none of those three children took interest in it. It's sort of like a pyramid.
That's what happened. Kids don't want to run their business, especially the immediate kids. Now the grandchildren may come along and want to do it, and then some of them may not need. Depends on what it is. Nowadays,
right.
with the emphasis on this science and technology, and that kids don't want to be involved in no business. No
yeah, I know of
That's outmoded. Who the hell wants to hang around the store all day long?
I knew of a guy, he and his wife, they had three children, and of course they split up, but before that, they were doing pretty well. They had a farm in Culpeper, Virginia, and one of the rare black folk that had a convenience store in the city, but kids weren't interested in it. They weren't none of it, the rental property, nothing. But I like your philosophy on things. All right, if you want to be a rocket scientist, fine. But I guess you got to start them off young when they don't have any choice. You're going to learn this aspect of what keeps the lights on your belly fed. Learn this. You got to do it at a young age. And then when they, become teens or preteens and start developing their own interests, they've got that foundation, so if they have to start over or whatever, they know how to run the business of the farm or whatever you got.
Well, yes, that's exactly right. You should raise your children where they self-dependent.
Right.
And they're going to have a job. They got to have a job that's well-paying jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got to learn. Teach them how to do investments.
Yeah, earlier the better.
You have investments that produce passive income that have produced another $70,000-$80,000 a year. That's the plus with your salary. That's pretty good.
Right.
That can be saved and put in other investments. And you won't have to have anything to worry about. You can go and travel and do whatever the heck you want to.
That's true. That's the way to think. Well, anyway, I'm going to knock off a little bit early today on the 5th of July. I'm going to find me something cool to hide under.
All right, L.A., I'll talk to you later.
Okay, talk to you later. Okay. All right, everybody, have a good rest of the day on this 5th of July, 2022.